Hey y'all, this is Nita and you're listening to Underground. Today I have a very interesting guest on my show. He's from my very own country. He's one of the first few people to actually bring the techno wave to India. He is a DJ, music producer, and a sound engineer. He has been with Pioneer for years. He organizes Comadres, which is one of the most top-notch music festivals in India. It takes place in the south of India. And he is also a part of Submerge Music, which is one of the most prestigious agencies, which holds talents and everything music. They do festivals and what have you. Submerge, however, is headed by somebody called Nikhil Chinappa, who's a very important figure in our country. He is the sole reason electronic music exists in our country. And our guest today and Nikhil Chinappa go way back, so he has stories with him. He talks about how he makes his music and how the whole evolution happened, in especially in India. So I bring you Taheen Mehta. Hey Taheen, how's it going?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm good too. So you were one of the first few people in India to actually start the techno wave. And you've been playing as a DJ for more than 2 decades now. You're not just a DJ and a producer, but you're also a qualified sound engineer from one of the most prestigious music schools in India, the SAE. You were also an international ambassador for the Berklee College of Music. You were appointed Pioneer Pro DJ for India since 2007. You also organize India's top music festivals, Comadres, which I'd also like to be a part of someday, you know. So tell me how it all started.
Well, it started without actually me knowing that things were starting, you know. My dad and my mom, they used to have parties at home quite often. And I knew all their friends and, you know, the kind of music they all liked. So my dad would say, look, you know what everybody likes, you know all their favorite tracks. So why don't you just, you know, play the music for them? Yeah, so that's basically how it started. I started DJing for my dad and my mom's. And then, you know, their friends would say, okay, Tuin knows all of the stuff that we like, so we're going to have a party at home. Can he come and, you know, play for us? And it just sort of like built up from there. And I think what really got my attention was the fact that music could change anybody's mood. You know, even if you had a like really crappy day, but you hear your favorite song and then suddenly everything is A-okay, you know, you're right back on track. And I think that's a very powerful thing that you can do with just music and listening to your favorite music. So that's what got me hooked to DJing, you know, just to see how people react to what you're doing, you know, the kind of music that you're presenting or the way you present it, and your ability to change people's moods, change people's nights, you know, give them a new perspective on life. Yeah, no, I know it sounds a bit deep, but it really is that way, you know, because that's what happened for me. Like, music changed my life. And, you know, I'm just trying to do my little bit to help others.
Yeah, that's really sweet. So you've been playing since 2 decades now. So since then, how has the music scene changed in India? And also, how have you evolved as an artist?
Wow. I mean, back then, everything was very rudimentary, right? Like, there was no internet. There was nothing. Like, you relied on, you know, the music stores in your various cities. Or if you had friends coming from overseas, you know, you would give them a list of CDs or records to pick up and they would bring it to you. So there was a lot of waiting, you know, and anticipating new music. There was no sense of discovery. Like, the DJs were the people who were discovering new tracks and then showcasing it to the audience. So in a way, we were very big tastemakers back then, and it was easy to kind of set your sort of brand, you know, like everybody gets to know you for the kind of music you play. And I think that was a very powerful thing. And if you could do it back then without the internet and all of that, it made life easier after the internet. Because, you know, I remember I would, when the internet came about and I started buying records, I would wait sometimes like a month and a half or 2 months just for like 4 or 5 records to reach me. Every day I would be, you know, I'd know when the post office would come to deliver, and every day at 4 p.m. I'd be at my gate waiting to see if today was the day the music arrived. Yeah, so there was a lot of waiting, and you really needed to be patient. But today, you know, things are very, very different with the internet. Everybody wants instant gratification. You know, you can't, if you play a song that was, let's say, 2 months old, people like come up to you and say, oh, why are you playing such an old song? You know, play something new. But I think that's where people don't realize that you lose out on a lot, because sometimes classics are like completely timeless. You know, there are times that I would dig into some of my original techno collection. Some of them are like 20, 25 year old tracks, you know, and then you can play them today and people will still react the way they did when I first got the tracks.
Yeah.
And there's no way for them to find them. You know, there's no way for people to find them, to know what this is. And I think that's the important thing. Like back then, people spent a lot of time producing tracks. Like DJs were DJs and producers were producers, you know.
Right.
There were very few who were actually producing and DJing at the same time. And if they were doing that, the number of releases they had per month were also a lot lower, because every release they actually spent a lot of time getting things right. Mm-hmm. And I think today, the you know, it's completely reversed, where if you're with a label, then you're under pressure from the label mm-hmm. to constantly put out music all through the year. Or if you have a management agency, then the management agency, you know, is constantly asking you to put out music. So again, it's art, right? Like you can't create art on demand. At least that's how I see it.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the sort of like negative aspects from what it was to what it is today. Mm-hmm. But there's also the flip side, is because of the internet, people are listening to a lot of other stuff, right? They're not just listening to the radio, or they're not just watching TV, like some music channels on TV, and getting brainwashed. So there's the internet and like Apple Music and Spotify and even all the regional, you know, music streaming services. And you can discover stuff that other people haven't, you know, and that's the cool thing. It sort of like opens up your mind. You're not, you know, programmed in a box anymore. You have your own taste, you have your own preferences. And in, you know, with regards to that, when people walk into a club, they also suddenly have an open mind, because they've also heard a lot of other music, you know. It's constantly changing and constantly evolving. So it's also very challenging for DJs to stay with the tide.
Yeah.
When things change, you also need to be able to change and sort of move into the new future that is mm-hmm. music today. So like from 92 to today, there's like a huge change. I started off on tapes, then I did CDs, and then I did vinyl, then, you know, I even did like Final Scratch and Serato when they were like version one. Final Scratch then became Traktor. So yeah, Ableton version one, version two. So I tried all of that, and then I slowly moved back towards, you know, DJing on hardware.
Wow, that must be so cool to actually evolve with the scene evolving.
Yeah, and also at that time, you had no pressure, right? There was no pressure for you to conform to a certain standard. Like, there was no pressure for you to say, oh, you have to only use Traktor, or you only have to use Serato. Everybody was free to use whatever they wanted to.
Yeah.
And I think that allowed me to explore, you know, parts of dance music and parts of DJ technology which other DJs hadn't, because they were very comfortable just doing what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
And today, you know, it's got me into a position where I've been with Pioneer for so many years, and, you know, I help them with product research and development. I do masterclasses for them. So again, it's like gone to the point where I'm trying to be at the bleeding edge of technology, you know, seeing mm-hmm. technology change before the general audience gets to see it. You know, like take, for example, the Pioneer DJM V10 mixer. You know, I knew about it like 5-6 years ago, so I knew that technology was coming. And to be able to foresee that particular change, you know.
Yeah.
Back then, it was impossible to predict anything because there was no internet. You know, you had to rely on magazines. I remember DJ Magazine. You could subscribe to it, and each copy was in 95 or 96, I think, was 375 rupees per magazine.
Okay.
Back then. And 375 rupees back then was a lot of money. If you had another 120 bucks, it was, you know, a CD full of music. So you had to kind of like weigh your options. Do I buy the magazine, or do I buy the music? Yeah. And also like the April issue of DJ Mag would come to India in June. So you read about the music, you read about the technology, you read about the hardware. And that's how we sort of like kept abreast with what's new and what's not. But today, man, internet, you literally just wake up and you look at your phone and you have all of the updates, you know, be it Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. It's sort of like we've become the now generation. And in a way, it takes away the charm from actually, you know, going to a record store and discovering music, like, you know, flipping through records, the smell. So that's something I feel sad that the new DJs don't
get to experience.
Necessarily get the yeah.
Yeah,
because I mean, we hardly have any record stores in India, and even if we do, it's all like the commercial stuff. I mean, I would you know, spend like between 4,000 and 5,000 rupees a month just buying records. They would come to me by post.
Mm-hmm.
But what I also would do is every 6 months I would make a trip to Singapore. Mm-hmm. And there was a store called Valentine Music. The owner's name was Annie.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go there for the weekend. So literally I would leave. I used to live in Chennai at that point. I would leave on a Friday night. So I would get into Singapore on a Saturday morning at 6 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
literally just going to the wine, and I would spend as little money as possible on the entire trip, right? Because I wanted to spend all the money on the music.
Yeah.
So I would check into the YMCA, which was literally a 2-minute walk from her store. I would just drop my bags, have a shower, and call her and say, "Look, I'm here," you know. And she's like, "Okay, okay, okay, la, coming to open this store." And I would be at her store by 9 in the morning. I would stay in the store from 9 in the morning till like she closes up at 8. So, and that would happen Saturday and Sunday, the entire day. And sometimes she would go on lunch breaks and she's like, "Can you handle the store?" I'm like, "Yeah,
oh
yeah, you go."
God.
And yeah. So I would just be sitting in the store going through music. And yeah, I mean, I did buy a lot of music, and I'm sure a lot of established DJs and, you know, the old school DJs will also recognize her because everybody went to her. And she knew all the DJs from India back then, actually all over the world, because that's where people came to buy music if you were in Asia. And
there are no records anymore, but do you think this store is still there?
Like, I honestly don't know if she still has a store. Okay. I haven't been to Singapore in many, many years, although I did try to get in touch with her, and somebody did say that she moved stores. But I mean, records are selling in record numbers now, you know.
Yeah.
Literally, I mean, people are starting to buy vinyl all over again. But it is expensive. And in India, it's hard for you to do vinyl sets all the time, one, because excess baggage, you know, carrying vinyl on an aircraft is incredibly hard.
Mm-hmm.
And getting good quality turntables in venues, that's also, you know, a rarity.
Yeah.
But I mean, I still do the throwback vinyl sets every now and then. Right now, it's the lockdown. I haven't done anything in 5 months. But I was actually planning to do an all vinyl sort of like old school throwback set with just music that I used to play back in the day and music that I kind of got known for, you know, which was like tribal and tribal tech. Yeah, I remember back then people would be like, "Man, what is this crap you're playing?" And and now after like, yeah, after 15 years, you know, I'd play these sets and, "Dude, this is such a good track, man. This was so far ahead of its time." And I'm like, that's exactly why I was playing it, you know, because it was such good music that you guys needed to hear.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the fun part. Like, I have maybe 300-400 records, and I know that every single one of them is a gold mine, you know, like I can play every single one and every single one is a hit. Unfortunately, I can't say that about all of the new music that's being released today, you know.
Yeah.
When we were DJing actively before the coronavirus, I would spend like, I don't know, $200 to $300 a month just on new music. And that's just downloadable new music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And how many of them can I term as classics? Very few, you know. Like, will I be able to play them, let's say 20 years from now? And would it work? I still have my doubts. But some of these, like, I knew that they would still work, and they still do.
So what made you pursue techno music? Like, what was your defining moment where you were like, "I love this and this is what I want to do"? So like, what was that for you?
So I think the defining moment for me in the way I perceived and understood dance music and the way it changed, it literally changed overnight on one CD. And it was by a DJ called Tony Devi.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, he was world number two. And unfortunately, the year after that, he passed away. He was supposed to be world number one. And in his place, Tiesto became world number one. But he was the godfather of Hard House. And there was one CD called Trade Global Grooves. And I bought it. And I remember paying like 750 rupees for it. And I was like, "Okay, let me just see what this is about." And I went home and I played it. And I just heard it from beginning to end. And I was like, "Okay, this is where it's at." There was actually a track in that CD, in that compilation, it was like a non-stop mix. Ministry of Sound had it on its annual dance compilation 8 years later. So that's how far ahead of time he was with his music selection. So like Tony Devi was, that was like a groundbreaking moment for me. I mean, before that I'd heard a lot of music from Josh Wink.
Mm-hmm.
So Josh Wink, Tony Devi, these two like really changed my perception. And then came Jeff Mills. You know, Jeff Mills was also there for a long time, but I got exposed to him a little later.
Mm-hmm.
So like these three became the pillars of my understanding and my motivation with dance music, you know.
Right.
I had the opportunity to meet Jeff and Josh.
Wow.
Unfortunately, yeah.
How
so
did that go?
That was really nice. I mean, I met Jeff Mills in ADE, the first time I ever went there.
Uh-huh.
And I was just blown away with how calm and serene he was as a person. You know, he's playing this banging music, but he's just so calm. It was very inspiring, very different for me to, you know, see that. Normally people get all hyped up about taking pictures and looking good. And he was just there doing what he does, you know, doing what DJs are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And then I met Josh Wink last year as well. He was actually in India on tour, mm-hmm. and I had the opportunity to open for him in Delhi. And that was probably one of my happiest days. I mean, you know, he's like one of the pillars of dance music for me. And he's so down to earth, so humble. Yeah, it just really reaffirmed my faith in old school ways. And, you know, seeing the music the way he was seeing it, I would always try and compare what I'm doing to like Josh, because he's extremely technical and he's just so good with what he does. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for him to like come up to me after the night and he's like, man, you were doing some like really cool stuff and you were playing some really cool music.
Wow.
That was a high point for me. Was a high point for me. You know, I felt like a little kid. that was really, really, really
wow,
nice.
That's insane. Wow.
I've never really played techno because it's cool or because it's techno. I've always played music. I've played different kinds of music all through my career. And at every point in my career, I've played the music that I actually like and I'm inspired by. And that's something that I would dance to. Mm-hmm. I would never play a track just because it was on the charts, you know, just because somebody said this is top 10 or top 100. I'm not going to play it. If I don't see myself dancing to it, mm-hmm. I'm not going to play the track. And that was just something that I followed. And I always liked energy. So.
Okay, so I've heard that they call you the wizard of equipment and that you're an old school DJ, you use turntables, you worked on analog gear. So there's so many creative ways to like create transitions when you're like moving from your master track to your slave track. What are your favorite go-to transitions that, you know, you like to make that make it seem so seamless?
So, I mean, right now, you'll hardly find me just mixing one track to another track.
Yeah.
In my current setup, I have anywhere from 3 to 4 CDJs. I carry my sampler. I have my 2 effects units. I have my synth. Mm. So I'm constantly layering something on a track that's already playing. So even if you know a track.
Mixing into a third track?
Yeah, constantly. If I have one track playing, my sampler is probably, I've either sampled something or I'm using it like a sort of like drum machine, layering my own percussion mm-hmm. on a track. Mm-hmm. Like let's say if a track is very minimal, mm-hmm. I would give it energy by maybe adding hats or cymbals or claps to give it, you know, a little more fullness, a little more energy. And then that would help me transition into a track that had more energy, because now I can go from a track that was empty, fill it up with my own percussion and use that as a transition point into another track.
Yeah.
So even if you knew both of those tracks, because of what I was adding just with a simple drum pattern, or if I was running, you know, my synth and I'm writing a synth line on it, it mm-hmm. suddenly becomes a new mix for you.
Yeah.
And that's the creative part that's kind of like got me hooked to what I'm doing now. Like with techno, it's so much about grooves. It's so much about like different layers. You know, you can have like, you have the kick, you have the bass, and then you have a whole bunch of space on top for you to do so many different things.
Yeah.
So right now I'm also doing a lot of hypnotic stuff. I mean, I've been doing hypnotic stuff for the last 2 years, but because I don't have a dance floor to constantly play out for, most of my live streams are purely hypnotic music because I don't get the opportunity to play that out, you know. But right now people are being forced to listen to that hypnotic music for like let's say 30 minutes or an hour. Uh-huh. And my hope is that over the course of how many months that we have to do this, people would get into that. They would get used to that, you know, style of DJing or that style of music. Uh-huh. So I don't really have a go-to as such if I'm going from one track to another. Most importantly is making sure my EQs sort of blend together well.
Yeah.
You should never have a situation where you've gone from track A to track B and the volume is either dropped, you know, or gone up. It's got to remain at even keel. You can, in the transition, you can bring the volume down to sort of like create the suspense and build up and tension. But when everything comes back into fullness, then you need it to be at the same volume. So gain control, EQ control, that's like the most important thing for me.
Yeah,
the most important thing. I mean, even if like when I've been judging DJ contests and, or if I've been mentoring somebody, it's always been that. You know, I always say I don't give a crap about the music that you're playing, but, you know, are you following the most basic steps of being able to blend things as smooth as possible? It's like if you go to a fancy restaurant, right? But the chef was crap, not cooking well, not, you know, mixing the right ingredients in the right order. Your food is going to turn out as crap. Yeah. Whereas you could go to a roadside cafe and the guy knows exactly what to do, how to make that sandwich or how to make that whatever or whatever. There's a certain procedure that you follow. And that's what I'm talking about. That's something that young DJs need to sort of pick up on with DJing today.
Yeah.
You know, the advent of a laptop on a DJ console has sort of changed that. Everybody starts, you know, looking at the laptop screen instead of actually vibing with the crowd or getting more hands-on control with the gear.
Yeah.
And I think that hands-on control, knowing what every knob, button, slider does, most people don't know. Yeah, no, knowing your gear is very, very important. Like, I've had people, really established artists, call me and say, look, I've, you know, picked up the RMX or I picked up this. What cables do I need to connect this gear?
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait. How do you buy the gear and not know what cables to pick up? Like, you just have to flip it around and see what the connectors are. So, yeah, I've had those situations before. That's the only thing I can give. Like, everybody has their own style, right? Like, there's a unique style in the way you're blending from one track to another. So never try to be like somebody else. Always try to be the best version of you that you can possibly be at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's governed by, one, the audience, two, the tracks that you're actually mixing between. Because if you have an audience that's high on energy, you can take two tracks that absolutely shit together, but still make it work.
Yeah.
You know, and it could be the other way. It could be the other way around, where these two tracks are amazing together, but the crowd is just very lackluster, and you could have done an easy mix, but it ends up being shitty. So
yeah,
it sort of goes both ways. It's things that most people don't think of, but that's how it is.
Yeah. Okay. So you've worked on analog gear when you're producing. So now when you produce, you have lots of sounds that do sound very analog-y. So what kinds of plugins or kinds of synths that you use that come close to that kind of analog sound?
So here's the thing. I've never really thought of it as analog sound or digital sound. For me, it's always been about listen to it. Don't look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't look at the screen. Don't look at the gear. Listen to what is being produced. Mm-hmm. If you like it, is it something that's in your taste? Go ahead and use it. So there is no right or wrong. You know, a lot of people say that, oh, this is a really shitty synth. It doesn't sound great. But that's a very subjective matter, right? Like, for you, it might sound shitty. But for somebody else, they could take that shitty sound and turn it into amazing music. So I don't really have a go-to as such, but as a for techno, I really feel like FM synthesis is a very, very powerful tool.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of sounds that you can make in FM synthesis, the kind of modulations that you're able to achieve, that's very intriguing for me. So a lot of my music does have sounds from FM synthesis. I also use a lot of analog sounds. Like, some of my percussion is all, you know, purely analog percussion. Analog, and sometimes I even use acoustic samples. It changes what your ear is listening to. You're not like, oh man, it's the same boring snares, same boring clap. So there's always something new for you.
Yeah.
And I also take those sounds and I use them with my sampler at a gig. So what happens when you come and listen to me play, you're still hearing those same toms or the same, you know, claps and hi-hats, and you make a direct correlation to something that I've produced because I've used those sounds there as well.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so it gives really you a cool idea. I will try.
Yeah, so it gives you a good bridge between what you're producing and what you're DJing. And I think that's very important today for artists. Now, it could be the both ways, right? You could be a producer who wants to be a DJ, or you could be a DJ who also wants to be a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to have content that's, you know, cross-platform, so to speak. You need to be able, if you're a good producer, you need to be able to take what you're good at and then bring it into the world of DJing.
Yeah.
And if you're a good DJ, you need to be able to take those skills into your production.
Right.
So it's just because you're a good DJ doesn't mean you're going to be a good producer. And just because you're a good producer doesn't mean you're going to be a good DJ. They're completely independent of each other. They're two different skill sets that people need to pick up on.
Yeah.
But having these things in mind, where at the end of the day, what you want to do, you want to create your brand, right? You want people to recognize you, your sound, your image, your persona, and all of it has to fit together. But the most important thing for a DJ is the sound. So getting people to recognize the sounds that you're using, that's very, 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 very important. Simple things like with the RMX, I have this sort of like hi-hat pattern that I create live.
Yeah.
And Now the pattern has become so synonymous with me. A lot of friends say, like, man, I walked into the club, I heard the hi-hat pattern, and I knew it was you. So it's small things, right? But this is what kind of sets you apart from everybody else. It's like, for example, Jeff Mills. You know, Jeff Mills, when he's DJing, he plays with the TR-909, the drum machine from Roland, the vintage drum machine. And he also has signature patterns, and that's a very signature Jeff Mills sort of set. So when you hear that, you know instantly that that's Jeff Mills playing. Nobody else does what he does. You know, so
That's an
it's
amazing
hard
difference.
for you to build that up. Obviously, it's not going to happen overnight. It needs many, many years of sort of figuring out what is you, what is your core, and then being able to translate it both in production as well as DJing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, also, so when you produce, all your songs have like this hypnotic, as you were telling me earlier, this hypnotic sound, and obviously these kind of sounds need to sound larger. So how do you achieve that kind of result without trying to make your track too loud? Like, how do you make your track sound larger irrespective of the volume?
Well, there are obviously a couple of things. A lot of people forget that dance music in general, there are multi-channel dance music, but everything is stereo. That there's left and right. You have a stereo field. You have things that are left and right. But with volume, you can also bring things up to your face. You can also push it back. You can also give you can also give elements air. So you can, like, if I was to give you a picture, right? You can have something that sits on the bottom of the picture, and then as I affect it, I can bring make the sound rise to the top. So it's like a three-dimensional, you have to look at it as three-dimensional space where you need to place your sounds. So when every sound has its own space, nothing is clashing against each other, suddenly everything seems more full,
So where do
more
you place
powerful.
what?
It's really dependent on the sound, right? Like, you want your kick and your bass to be like
In
center in your
space,
face.
yeah.
Yeah, but like synths depends on the kind of synth you're doing. You can have like these floaty synths with like which stay on the top, or you can have these like really mangled synths that maybe start on the left, go to the right, and then come back into the center. It's about a lot of movement that people forget. There's like people say like drama, right? Everybody's drawn to drama,
Yeah, of
and
course.
that's what you need to do with dance music as well. You have to create those moments. So knowing what kind of sound goes where. Like even toms, right? Like if you have toms that are on the bottom of the mix, they're obviously going to feel more full and more rounded. But you can have toms that, you know, you start on the bottom and float to the top by thinning the toms out and, like, you know, adjusting reverb, adjusting volume. Obviously, it comes with a lot of experience. You need to know your room, know your headphones, know how to create those situations, and that's, you know, that soundscape. But yeah, that's basically it. There is no like set formula for everything. You want your hats and everything to sound like big. Like when the hats come on, you know, you want it to like fill the room. Like you need it to be like cutting through the mix. Your claps can be like in your face, or they can float from left to right. Again, it's all dependent on the kind of track that you're making. But these are the little things. Like every bit of sound that you're putting into the track, you can give it movement. And when you give it movement, it becomes complex. So here's the thing. You can take a track with exactly 10 elements, right? That's a very simple track. But with movement, it suddenly becomes extremely complex. Because you have 10 things. Okay, maybe not 10 things, kick and bass, not moving so much, but like eight other things which are moving constantly and creating that sort of hypnotic vibe. Yeah,
That's
and like
true.
techno, there's no open melodies, right? We're not producing trance or like pop music with like heavy vocals and stuff. Yes, although there are some tracks with vocals, but you always need a hook. So a hook can be a bass line, or it can be a lead, or maybe even a percussion pattern that sort of becomes a hook for the track. So creating a hook for me is very, very important.
So, when you're making a hook for a track, do you, okay, so when you start a track, do you already have a hook in mind or you sort of grow into it?
Sometimes, so, yeah, sometimes I already have a hook in mind. Maybe, you know, it's something that I've heard. What I do is I listen to, at home, I don't listen to any dance music whatsoever.
What?
Yeah, I'm listening to like, I listen to like, you know, rock and country and pop and all sorts of stuff. But I get, I have like this playlist that I keep making on Apple Music, and then, you know, I just fill it with stuff that I like. And some of my tracks actually have melodies which I've lifted from country tracks. Like a part of a melody that I heard in a country track, I've picked it up and I've turned it into
something else.
Something. So sometimes if I hear something that's really, you know, catching, then I make a note of it and then I start with that. Like, okay, this is it. And I want to build a groove around it. Right. Or sometimes if I don't have anything in mind, then I start, you know, building a groove and then I start adding things.
But yeah.
Kick and like kick and bass. That's initially what I start with. And then everything latches after that. Kick, bass, hi-hat and your cymbals. For me, that's, that's my starting point. But again, it depends on the kind of music you're making, right? Like if you're trying to create that hypnotic style, then the less elements you have, the better, because then you can make each element have its own space in the mix, thereby becoming more impactful and intense to the listener. Because most people, when they listen to hypnotic music, they get, they think it's monotonous because they haven't, you know, had the time to actually listen to it and look at all the elements that are actually in the track and what's going on in the track. So to an untrained ear, it can be monotonous. But if you really make impactful hypnotic music, I'm telling you, people will start vibing.
As a DJ that, you know, you have gigs back to back, like almost every second day. How do you like create sounds and like different kinds of sets to keep it fresh?
So here's the thing. I never create sets. At every gig, it's always a fresh set. So even if I'm doing a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I might play the same tracks, but every gig, the order of the tracks would be different. Or what I'm doing with the sampler on top of the tracks would be different. Or the synth lines that I'm writing real time would be different. So that's how I keep it unique, even if I'm playing the same track. So even if you give me 10 tracks and say play it 10 times over, each time is going to be different, because I'm doing something different. Having said that, sometimes at a gig, I maybe wrote a synth line that really, really works, or a percussion pattern that really, really works. And with the Pioneer sampler, I quickly save it, you know, as a sample and say, then I can recall it anytime at any gig. Sometimes you have these little happy accidents, you know, that you want to recreate. Or maybe you want to recreate it in the studio. So you just, you know, make a quick sample of it and save it, and then come back and analyze it and say, okay, can I work this out? Can I make something better of it? Then just push forward.
So what has been like your biggest challenge in producing today?
Well, I'm not a good producer. So that's the biggest challenge. I'm not good with, I hate looking at a computer screen. I hate looking at software. That's been my stumbling block. And software is constantly changing. Like every update, there's something new for you to learn. So that's been the frustrating part. So every time I hit that block, I just pull out the hardware and then start, you know, making maybe just a simple groove, you know, on the hardware. And then I would copy that over to the computer and then move forward with it. So that's, for me, that's the hardest part. I can hold my own as a DJ. I'm not, I don't consider myself to be a great producer, but I have ideas, you know, for me. So it takes me a while for me to put it down because I'm not that great. With the computer. I'm not good friends with DAWs. It's like I have the idea. I know what I need to do, but that's the other problem. Sometimes you have these great ideas and then you sit in front of a computer and you just can't seem to recreate it.
So I'm curious then, because you have so many releases, then if you don't like producing, how often do you produce?
When I feel like it. when I feel motivated. I'm very old school that way. I can't work under pressure. It's important to make music when you feel like making music and not be under the pressure that you have to finish it. It's a different thing that if you set yourself, like if you start making a track and then you say, okay, I need to finish this track in 5 days, that's a very good thing, right? Like setting yourself a target to finish that particular idea. But you can't just sit in a studio and say, okay, I have to make 10 tracks this month.
Okay, so I have another question. I sometimes have a hard time finishing something that I've started, or
It's all the time. It's all the time. I have a whole bunch of loops that I have created, and that's that 90% of the time that's what happens. It just sits as loops. But fortunately for me, because I play techno, a lot of the time I take those loops and I test it, you know, at a gig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Test it to see is it working? Are people feeling it? And if they are feeling it, then I know what direction to take with it at some point. But having unfinished tracks is very, very normal. So that's something that you shouldn't worry about.
But I'm working on trying to finish them. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's what I said. Setting yourself a target to finish them, that's important. Mm-hmm. But it's absolutely normal to also have a whole bunch of unfinished tracks.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Because 90% of the time we start working on a track. And let's say you work on it for 2 days. And on the third day, you listen to it. You're like, wait, I want to start another idea. And then you create a new project and you start with another idea. That happens as well.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think the first one that I released after a very long time, it was like 3 or 4 tracks. Uh-huh. And I was working on all 4 tracks at the same time. Two days I would work on one track. And then third day I'd get like bored with it and I'd say, screw it. And I start another track. And then again, 2 days later, I'm like, oh, I can't listen to this. And then I start a third track. And I'm like, oh, wait, I have this idea. Maybe I can use it in the first track. And then open the first track again and put that idea on the first track. So, yeah. But again, like I said, you need to be in a very good mental space for you to be able to do that.
So after so many years into this lovely industry and trying out and doing so many things and achieving all that you have, what would you say to someone who is relatively new in the industry? And what advice would you give us?
Don't give up. That is the most basic thing. And it's very, in today's world, the competition is so difficult. Right now, a lot of DJs have, young DJs who've been using DJing as a source of income. All the venues are shut. Everything is shut. Maybe they don't have enough of a saving. They've actually foregone their careers and, moved on to something else.
Yeah.
It's right now is a very, very tough situation for all of us, whether you're a new DJ or an established DJ, because there's literally no money coming in. But if music is what you love, then don't give up. That's the most important thing. Because if we, as people who love music, start giving up on the music, then how do you expect anybody else not to? If you give up, you're a DJ, you're this big artist. If you give up, imagine what your fans will feel. Okay, I don't like to use the word fans, or your listener base, people who support you, who've been at every gig of yours, or who've craved to be at every gig of yours, right in that front row. You're not doing justice to the music. All of us go through tough times at various stages in our lives, but it's very important not to give up. I remember in Goa in 2008, I was riding a bike and I was going to the after party and I crashed. I broke my hand. I was in hospital for 2 days, had surgery in Goa. The day they released me from the hospital, I told Nikhil, I said, I need to get back to the console. And I went straight back to the console and Nikhil was just standing behind me, putting the headphones on, taking it off, putting it on. Yeah, because for me, that's what pulls me out of a tough situation. The music has always pulled me out of a tough situation.
Yeah.
In 2017, I was coming home from one of Nikhil's gigs. I was in a cab coming home and the cab crashed and I broke my leg. And I was in the hospital, had surgery. And I was bedridden for 4 months. And my first gig after that was Supersonic. And Nikhil's like, look, are you really going to be able to make it? I was like, if I have to be on a wheelchair on the DJ console, I'm going to make it. That's basically it. So that's what kept me going. Those 4 months of just sitting at home and staring at the four walls. Yeah, not able to do anything. And all I could think of was that this is my next gig. This is what I need to work forward to. So all my physical therapy, just waking up and saying, okay, I had something to work forward to, Don't give up. Don't give up. I know a lot of people don't even think about it, but that's the most basic thing. Just don't give up. And it's not just for young DJs. It's for anybody. It's completely universal. Yeah. If you like something, you just hold on to it as much as you can.
Okay, keeping that in mind. Thank you so much for coming on my show and giving me your time.
Anytime.
And sharing your lovely thoughts. It was really lovely having you, honestly. So
thank you. So I had a good time.
I learned a lot.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about music. We learn from each other, There's no senior, junior in this. We're all learning all the time. I'm happy to have been able to share all of this with you and your listeners.
Thank you. All right, so that was Tehin Mehta. And if you guys have any sort of questions that you would like me to ask my guests or any sort of suggestions, please feel free to send me a voice message. You can do that by clicking on the link below. Or you could also send me a text message on Instagram. You can reach me at Nida Chakrabarty. It's spelled NIDACHAKRABORTY, no spaces. And I will see you guys next week. And thank you for tuning in.